Now, if you follow or even just listen into a lot of the reporting on the United States these days, you'd be tempted to believe that hyper-religious conservatives have captured American culture, especially in this election year. But the Harvard professor Robert Putnam and his colleague David Campbell have conducted one of the biggest studies of religion ever undertaken in the United States and come up with some surprising results. Bob Putnam is most famous for his groundbreaking book, Bowling Alone. Released in 2000, it traced the decline of community life in America. More recently, he and David Campbell have written American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. And in American Grace, which is now out in a paperback edition, they uncover some surprising facts. In this, the first of a two-part interview, Bob Putnam begins by dispelling one of the biggest stereotypes about religion in the United States.
The most startling point is that actually if you talk to individual Americans about people who have different faiths than they do, or even no faith at all, in our private lives, Americans are remarkably tolerant of people across religious lines. It's true that in public, we've been fighting for the last 20 or 30 years about religiously derived issues, above all abortion and homosexuality. But actually in our private lives during those very same periods, we've become more and more tolerant across religious lines. Most non-religious Americans believe that religion is basically a force for good in America, and most religious Americans believe that you can be a perfectly good America and not have a religious faith. Both in our media and in your media, I think the degree to which this polarization has divided our society is exaggerated or at least misstated.
For many of us, the biggest myth was shattered, and that was that white males in the United States are less religious of all the demographic groups.
That's certainly true. They're less religious than women, and they're a lot less religious than men or women of color.
You pose up front in the book this question: how can religious pluralism coexist with religious polarization? How do they achieve that? How does America achieve that?
First of all, you need to set the stage by saying that Americans, by comparison to any other advanced country in the world, are very religious. The average American is slightly more religiously observant than the average Iranian, for example. So we're very religious. And we're also, at least in our public life, divided along religious lines. And most places in the world that are deeply devout and deeply divided in religious terms are also characterized by mayhem. Think Northern Ireland or Baghdad or Bombay or Beirut. And yet Americans turn out to be remarkably tolerant. And that's the puzzle. How could we be so tolerant if we take religion seriously and are also divided? And the answer, we think, comes from the fact that in the very same years in which we've become more divided religiously, and at least in terms of our politics, in our private lives, been busy building all sorts of personal ties that cross religious lines. So, that, for example, most marriages in America today, unlike 50 years ago, cross religious lines, what we call interfaith marriages, in which a Catholic marries a Protestant, or a Jew marries a Protestant, or a Mormon marries a Catholic, or somebody who doesn't have any religion at all, marrying someone who's devoutly Buddhist or devoutly Catholic or whatever. Those sorts of interfaith marriages are now typical. And what that means is that all of us have likely to have some encounter with people who are of a different religious orientation than we are. About 40% of all Americans have changed their own religious affiliation from that of their parents or from that of their children. And that means in our own families, we're divided in religious terms. And moreover, most of us have many close friendships in other religious communities. It's very hard to demonize a group if you love someone who's in that group, as most Americans do. We say in the book...
Yes, you have a story about Aunt Susan, don't you?
Absolutely. Aunt Susan is a wonderful human being. She's the salt of the earth. She's the person who remembers birthdays and brings chicken soup if you get sick and always is out volunteering. But unfortunately, Aunt Susan is some different faith than you are. You're Catholic and she's Protestant, or you're Protestant and she's Mormon, or you're Mormon and she's Jewish or whatever. And you know that your faith says, the theology says, poor Aunt Susan, nice lady, not going to make it to heaven. But, I mean, you know, Aunt Susan is a wonderful person. I don't know whether I'm going to heaven, but Aunt Susan for sure is. And you can see all Americans making this kind of syllogism. Well, Aunt Susan is going to make it to heaven, therefore maybe other people are too. The astonishing thing is that the overwhelming majority of Americans, 80 or 90% of Americans, say that a good person, not of their faith, can nevertheless go to heaven.
That's correct. And that figure includes evangelical Christians.
Most evangelical Christians in America say that even non-Christians are going to go to heaven. Now, from their point of view, that's the wrong answer. I mean, Jesus was very clear about this. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the light. Except through me, there's no access to the Father. I mean, that's pretty clear. And yet most evangelicals, when we ask them, say, yes, even non-Christians, if they're good, are going to be able to make it to heaven. And that, we think, is explicable by Aunt Susan or by my pal, Al. Al and I, Al's a beekeeper, I'm a beekeeper. We go out doing whatever beekeepers do. One day after beekeeping, I learned to my shock that Al is a Mormon. Well, I don't know any other Mormons, and I always a little prejudiced against Mormons, but I mean, Al's a great guy. So you can see Americans, in effect, saying, well, you know, if Al's a Mormon, maybe Mormons are okay. So these personal networks have bound Americans together and, in a way, integrated American society, even across these lines that otherwise appear pretty deep.
And, in fact, if there is a split, I think I recall reading where you say that it's between the faithful and their religious leaders, because the religious leaders believe that if their followers have this rather capacious, inclusive view of who goes to heaven, maybe we haven't done our jobs correctly.
That's right. I had a remarkable experience in which I spoke to the annual meeting of the theologians in the most conservative Christian denomination in America, the Missouri Synod Lutherans, they're called. And when I reported these facts, that even Missouri Synod Lutherans in the pews believe that non-Christians can be saved, there was deep gloom in the audience, because they said, how could they, our faithful, how could, we've been telling them that every day. This is not a complicated question. How do they get it wrong? And the answer, of course, is Aunt Susan.
Professor Putnam, tell us about the shock and aftershock in America that shook up the religious world. What was that shock?
In the 1950s, Americans were all kind of moderately in the middle. They were not terribly religious, but fairly religious. And then came the first of several shocks, like an earthquake, came the 1960s. And the 1960s divided American societies in many, American society in many ways, as it did other countries in the world, of course. Politically, it was the Vietnam War, and in gender terms, it was the feminist revolution, and in racial terms, it was the civil rights revolution. And there were also major changes in sexual mores. People became much, much more relaxed about, for example, premarital sex. And many, at the same time as those so-called liberating waves were sweeping across America, it was a shock that sent a bunch of younger people off to the more secular end of the spectrum. So you have to imagine an earthquake, and then one side of this split is this growing number of fairly secular Americans, not really atheists, but they've sort of left the sphere of religious influence. But then there were another group of Americans, and this was the first aftershock, who in the 1970s and 1980s were appalled by what they saw, not as liberation, but as the collapse of fundamental features of Western morality that had been held to be true for 2,000 years. And they moved off to the more religious end of the spectrum, looking for the part of the religious spectrum that would be most articulate in defending what came to be called family values. And that was the origin of the religious right. So the first shock sent one group of Americans off in a secular direction. The first aftershock sent another group of Americans off to the more religious end of the spectrum, what came to be called the religious right.
Let's speak now about this second aftershock, which we're still feeling. This began, I think, in the early 1990s. This was the kind of counter-reaction to the counter-reaction.
Well, as the evangelicals and religious conservatives began to become more powerful and more assertive publicly in their involvement in politics, and as political conservatism, especially about issues of abortion and homosexuality, became, in a way, the calling card of religion in America, a new generation of Americans coming of age in the 1990s and then into the 21st century began to say to themselves, Well, if religion is just about being conservative and being Republican, being a member of the Republican Party and you know, hostile to homosexuals and so on, that's not me. I'm out of here. And there has been a extremely rapid growth in a category that sociologists in America call the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not Catholic sisters, but the people who say, when you ask them what religion they say they have none, they have no religious affiliation. And that number, which historically was about 5 to 7% of Americans, just in the course of the last two decades has risen. Among younger Americans, that's risen to about 33-35%. So it's an incredibly rapid change. It's important to understand a couple of things about the growth of this, what are sometimes called the young nuns. One, most of them are not atheists. These are not people who've been convinced by the new atheism, so-called, of Dawkins and others. Most of them say they believe in God. Most of them were raised in religious homes. Many of them still pray. Some of them say that religion is an important part of their lives, but they are very alienated from organized religion. That's the crucial thing. Secondly, although this looks a little superficially like the century-long process of secularization in Western Europe and perhaps also in Australia, the structure of this change in America is quite different. It's not been going on as it has in England, say, for, you know, a percentage point or two every decade for more than 100 years. In America, it's all happened in the last 20 years. There's one factor that distinguishes the young nuns from the people who have stayed in church, and that is they're really upset about mixing politics and religion. So just as the evangelicals were reacting against the 60s, so this young secular group is reacting against the 70s and 80s and reacting against the religious right. And that reaction is continuing to grow. We, just last summer, did another national survey in America, and we could see many of the same people that we had talked to ourselves 4 or 5 years earlier and who then said they were Methodist or Catholic or Baptist or whatever, now calling themselves nun out of alienation from the political activities of organized religion.
Yes, you say that for many young people, and indeed for many religious people, they sat out those culture wars of the 1990s, of the Clinton era.
Yes, and the people that we're talking about now, these young people who become more secular, are exactly the people who would otherwise have been in church. These are not people who've been hostile to religion per se, but they in effect said, if all we're going to do in religion is just get angry over these political issues, that's not me. If that's what it means to be religious, then I must not be religious. Even to evangelical leaders, I've spoken to a lot of evangelical leaders. It's clear now that evangelicalism and indeed religion in America is paying a huge price for having gotten, in an organizational way, too close to politics. It's important to understand the rise of evangelicalism, which began in the 1970s, ended by 1990. I know that's not the way it's seen in the public press, but the data are perfectly clear. The rise of evangelicalism occurred between 1970 and 1990 and then ended.
Oh, yes, you say quite explicitly it is a feature of the past, not of the present.
That's correct.
And that seems to be reflected in the attitudes of people like Rick Warren, a mega church pastor who has books that sell in the tens of millions, and yet he does not want to be, it seems, the kind of religious leader that Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson was in the 1980s.
That's exactly right. And he is the poster boy, I would say, for this younger generation of evangelical leaders who recognize with horror that they made, and you'll excuse the expression, a bargain with the devil when they got too close to politics, and they want to get out of that bargain. Many of these evangelical leaders, like Rick Warren, they are in the business of saving souls. They're not in the business of politics. And in our most recent surveys, we see this through the eyes of the people sitting in the pews, that the number of religious sermons in America over the last 5 years has been cut in half. Why are most religious leaders talking less about politics or social issues in church? Because they're kind of like businessmen or entrepreneurs. They want to have people in the pews, and if the constant harping on right-wing politics is driving people away, as it is, well, it's more important to them to get back to the basics of religion. And that, I think, is what we're probably in the midst of seeing that. It's not yet shown up in public opinion polls, but that's exactly what I expect to be happening. In short, I think this period that began with the 60s and that is now, I think, in its twilight will, in historical terms, be seen as a kind of parenthesis in American history. Americans have always been unusually religious from the very beginning. And our views about social issues, have often been linked to our religion, mostly, I have to say, on the left, not on the right. Most of the major progressive or left-wing social movements in American history have come out of churches. The abolition movement, which ended slavery in the 19th century, was a direct consequence of an evangelical revival in the 1830s and 1840s. The Civil Rights Revolution came directly out of churches, black and white. This period that we're just ending, in which God seemed to be only a Republican, is a very unusual period, and the price is now being paid both by religious leaders who are seeing their flocks graying as young people don't show up, and I have to say, I think it's very likely that the Republican Party too will pay a price for continuing to harp on these older so-called social or family values issues.
That's the Harvard professor Robert Putnam, co-author of American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. Join us next week for the second part of that interview, in which Bob Putnam explains new research on why young Americans are becoming simultaneously more conservative on abortion, but more liberal on sexuality. That's the program next week. Now, before we go, as you know, we've been keeping an eye on moves in the Vatican. Well, this week, John Allen writes in the National Catholic Reporter that the Vatican has warned the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, which is basically 80% of American nuns, that if it doesn't accept reforms to curb its liberal tendencies, the Vatican might decertify the conference in favour of a more religiously orthodox organisation. We'll keep an eye on that. But that is the programme for this week. Thanks to our producer, Noel Debien. Go to our homepage at the Radio National website for the full version of the program or for individual segments. And very soon I'll crank up my old Twitter account, which is Andrew West ABC.